This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and we're here once again to answer your animal behavior questions. So, if you wonder why your animals do some of the amazing things they do, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls this hour, we'll have another special topic to share. And what is it this time, Patricia?
Well, we're going to find out if your pooch is top dog at the dog park by talking about how watching dogs play can tell us a lot about who is who in the social hierarchy.
Cool. And we'll also welcome an avian trainer to the program to tell us how to raise and train the perfect parrot companion. That's still ahead, so stay tuned. But first, let's take a call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Nick. I'm from Norman, Oklahoma.
Nick, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a one-year-old dog. We don't know exactly what her breeds are. She appears to be pit bull and then what I'm assuming to be a heeler.
Okay.
Kind of a mix in there. And we have a situation now. I'm in school, as is my girlfriend, and during the day we have to put her outside. And we have a 6-foot privacy fence all the way around our yard, and she can jump the fence
Ooh.
Anywhere all the way around the yard.
Now, why do you have to put her outside?
We have to put her, well, she likes to chew on things, and we came home one day, and she had found a way, she had found that she really likes the taste of our piano.
And this is, yeah, this is, you know, a big stick. Just a big, shiny stick. Have you tried to crate train her or teach her to live in an X-pen or a place where she can't get into trouble?
No, actually, no, we haven't.
You know, that is exactly what I would do. If you don't, with a young dog like that, it's absolutely understandable that they're going to get in trouble with their mouths. You know, that's what they get in trouble with, usually one end or the other. Gets them in trouble when they live in your house when they're young and they haven't learned good habits yet. So what I would do is go out and get a big crate. Get a nice big crate. They're not that expensive. Go to a big pet store, catalogs, get a big crate where she can be really comfortable in it. But don't just put her inside and leave her there all day. That's not going to work out, right? She needs to get used to it. So for, oh, I don't know, a week or so, what I want you to do is to just throw treats inside the crate and let her run in and out. You know, do it 15 times in a row. And you can put it on cue. Go in your crate. Go in your crate. Go in your crate. Feed her in the crate. And when she's really, really sleepy, you might want to lure her into the crate, ask her to lie down, and just sit down beside it and let her nap for a couple of minutes. Now, dogs who are about a year old often aren't very sleepy very often. but nonetheless, the idea is to ease her into this. And slowly, you know, gradually you're going to throw a treat in there, maybe a hollow toy with food stuffed inside, shut the door for 5 seconds, and then let her out and take the toy away. So she's like, no, wait, don't bother me. I was not done yet. So you sort of do a little reverse psychology and then ease her into it. I would never trust a year-old dog alone in a house, especially since she's gotten into these not-so-good habits. I have a 15-month-old dog, and he's in a crate right now. And he loves his crate. He's very happy to go into it.
Well, what's the recommended amount of time that you said to leave the dog inside the crate?
Well, I'll tell you ideally, and then we'll discuss real life. Ideally, you have a trust fund, and you're home all day, and she's never in the crate more than, you know, 3 or 4 hours. But that's you know, one life, and then there's the other life where those of us have to work to buy the dog food.
Mm-hmm.
So given that she's a year old and her bladder is now, you know, she's matured, she can go 8-9 hours in there eventually. Once she gets used to it. Is that ideal? No, of course not. But if she gets lots and lots of exercise beforehand and after, eventually I'd like you to be able to leave her loose in the house. But for now, that's perfectly okay.
Good luck, Nick. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Patricia, we heard from Valerie in Duluth, Minnesota. She listens to us, by the way, on KUWS in Superior, Wisconsin. And Valerie just adopted 2 abandoned kitties. And one is 6 weeks old, the other is 10 weeks old. And she'd like them to be able to play outside while she works in the garden. But she lives in the country where there are a lot of predators and dangers around. And her question to you is this: how do I teach motherless kittens what to be afraid of? How does a mother cat teach her kittens how to be safe and cautious? The 10-week-old seems quite fearless at this point, but the 6-week-old hides from all unknown moving objects. Is this an age difference or perhaps a personality difference?
It's a personality difference. I've seen 6-week-old kittens who were just like, bring it on, bring it on. And there are others that are those shy, retiring little scaredy cats. You know, that's where that phrase surely came from. So I think it's mostly a personality difference. And your original question about how do you teach, how do you take on the role of a mother cat? There are a couple of things to think about. One is you can't really, obviously, you can never really quite be there with them all the time. But also keep in mind that mother cats don't know what you know. They don't know what's dangerous and what's not. What I would suggest you do is create a kind of a fenced yard. People are doing this more and more and more. And with little kittens, you can even just get what are called X-pens that they actually put puppies in. Sort of a little portable fence creates this little tiny little yard. You can put your kittens out in that, let them play outside. And that gets some time outside, and then they're really safe. And the wild animals are safe from them as well as they get older. So I've known people who are more and more building little fenced yards for kitties. Now, they need to be a little different than fenced yards for dogs because cats are a little more mobile. But screen porches are another idea. And the other possibility is, especially since they're so young, get them started on harnesses. You know, they're very young.
Good idea.
And you can get them used to them relatively early. Don't just slap them on them and sort of haul them around. Do it real slowly. But that's another possibility. So I would be aware, in summary, that it is dangerous out there for kittens. Mother cats can't always do that job either. And I think mostly your job is to protect them logistically.
And if anyone else wants to email us a question, how do they do that?
They just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And you could also do it through our website at callingallpets.org, if I'm not mistaken. That'd be a good way to send a question to us as well.
We'd love to hear from you.
And if you'd like to phone, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Sally from Wanakee, Wisconsin.
Hi, Sally. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a 10-year-old female Springer Spaniel, and this last spring we ended up buying a cabin up north. And when we leave her in the cabin, she is not liking that. She likes to whine and howl and that type of thing. And she doesn't do that at home at all. We've never had that problem. And I'm thinking it's probably a new place, a separation type of thing. But how do we deal with it?
Yeah, smells differently.
Doesn't feel like home. She probably felt like, what am I doing here? And it's not homey. It doesn't smell right. And now they've gone and left me.
Yeah.
So, there are a couple things you can do. I would basically treat this like a mild case of separation anxiety. Sounds like that's what's going on. The only other possibility is that she's whining and howling because she's just so frustrated. Take me on the walk in the woods. But let's presume that it's more anxiety related based on the whining and the howling rather than just sort of barking. So what I would suggest you do is figure out what food, going back to our friend food, what does she love? And you want to get something really, really good that she absolutely adores, really special. Stuff it into a hollow toy. And then what I want you to do is not leave for an hour or even 5 minutes. People will say, oh, I know you're just supposed to leave for a little short period of time with them with food inside a hollow toy. 5 minutes is an eternity if you're terrified, right? So what I want you to do is put it down, walk to the door, open the door, shut the door, and then take the toy away when it's still full of chicken or turkey. So she's like, what? Why did you come back? I'm not done yet. And gradually get her used to being alone. That's going to be your best bet in terms of getting her comfortable there. And if you possibly can, when you first go up, try and not go off for too long when you first get there. If at all possible, when you get there, even take her in the car if you're going to go out to eat that night or something, if she's comfortable in the car. Mm-hmm. Don't leave her there. And then the next morning, do your little tiny little comings and goings and see how that goes.
You take her little bed with her when you go?
Yeah, she's got her own dog bed up there that we took from home.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I don't know, you try to make her as comfortable, and we brought some of her toys from home, so she's, has something that's familiar from home.
But it just doesn't feel like home yet.
We go out fishing and we can hear her across the lake.
Oh, honey. Oh, poor girl. Try and ease her into it a little bit more.
Sounds great.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, you know, sometimes if you're going fishing, I should have mentioned, take her along.
You know, some dogs love to be in boats. Others, not so much. So
yeah.
It's going to depend a lot on her.
But it's really cool. I do a little fishing, and it's really fun to see somebody else going along, going past us at a relatively slow speed, but the dog will be right up in the bow of the bowl.
Right, like
up.
One of those figureheads, right? It was so cute. Now, could the dog – you're the fisherman, Larry. If the dog makes noise, sort of paddling around, clicking nails around the bottom of the boat, would that scare the fish?
Nah, most of the time not. It wouldn't be that. It wouldn't
not
be that
big
noisy.
A deal.
And frankly, a lot of boats these days are carpeted. And
no so, kidding.
Oh yes, mine is.
So well, what do
that
I know?
Muffles
well,
the
why
sound.
Haven't you taken me out on your boat,
I don't
Mueller?
Know. We've
well,
do
I'm
that.
Waiting.
And we're waiting for some more calls too at 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, discover whether your dog is king of the dog park just by observing the way he plays. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and it's time now for this week's topic. And, Tricia, you mentioned you have some useful tips for the next time we watch our dogs play at the dog park.
I do, and this is from the research of Drs. Erica Bauer and Dr. Barbara Smuts at the University of Michigan Ann Arbor, who discovered some really interesting information about what play can tell us about who's who in a dog social hierarchy.
Well, tell us how they did it.
Well, they watched 23 pairs of puppies playing, you know, at a park or some nice playful yard, and they very carefully recorded certain types of behavior. One of the things they were interested in was how often do dogs reverse roles? For example, if one dog was the chaser, then would he be the chasee just as often?
That's interesting. What did they notice?
Well, first of all, not surprisingly, just like with people, they notice there's a lot of variation, right, between the individuals involved in the way they played. But they noticed that some behaviors during play were equally likely to be performed by either dog.
Okay.
You know, so for example, what ethologists call attacks, just meaning like, you know, those little playful lunges where a dog like lunges and bites at.
Chase games kind of.
Well, and chase games. That's a separate category. Those were often done by dogs who just switched from one role to the other.
Wondering about things like mounting, muzzle biting. These are usually associated with dominance. What'd they see there?
Yes, and there's the rub because those two behaviors were never involved in role reversals. They were only done by individuals, mounting and muzzle biting, who were already known to be dominant with the dog with whom they were playing. Now, conversely, muzzle licking was also never done by both dogs. In this case, it was only done by dogs who were subordinate.
Okay. Very, very interesting.
So here's what we know about those three behaviors, mounting and muzzle biting and muzzle licking. We know in wolves and dogs that those correlate with social status in context outside of play. And obviously, as you know, as we said, mounting and muzzle biting, as you said, Larry, is related to high social status, whereas muzzle licking, you know, that little submissive little nom, 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 is correlated to low social status.
So if you want to know who's who at the dog park or maybe in your backyard, all you have to do is watch for those, I guess, three behaviors and see which dog engages in them the most.
That's right. However, this is an important however. Keep in mind that much like people, some individual dogs just don't care that much about social status, but others are obsessed with it. So you're not necessarily going to see your dog or all dogs mount or muzzle bite or muzzle lick during play. But we do know that who chases who just doesn't mean very much, except maybe who's the fastest.
Well, let's see who's the fastest at dialing 1-800-462-7413.
Very nice, Larry.
Have somebody online. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, guys.
Who are we speaking with?
This is James from Baltimore.
Baltimore, Maryland. James, thanks a lot for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 4-year-old collie mix named Judy. I adopted her from the SPCA, and she's been a wonderful dog. And I love her to death. There is a small problem at the dog park, and, you know, it's really not a problem from my perspective. It's just me kind of worrying about Judy's quality of life.
Yeah, what happens?
You know, you go to the dog park, everybody's got their dogs out there. They're all running around, you know, chasing each other, you know, displaying some of the behavior that she just spoke about.
Mm-hmm.
Judy, on the other hand, kind of just sits there. She watches the other dogs, but it's almost like she doesn't feel like, you know, she can really get involved. I'm not sure what's going on with her psychologically, but, you know, she doesn't run over to the dogs. She, you know, she just kind of has this dismayed look.
She's probably overwhelmed.
You think she's overwhelmed?
Yeah, yeah. How old was she when you got her?
She was a puppy, so she was, I think, like 6 months old.
Okay, so puppy, but really early adolescent. And, you know, the critical period of socialization in dogs is 7 to 13 weeks or so. And so it may be that she didn't have a lot of experience playing with other dogs. It may be that just her personality, her genetically designed personality, is a little shy and a little retiring. And that's not uncommon in dogs also. So if she looks, you know, you said she looks dismayed. So it may be that the dog park is just too much for her. You know, the dog park isn't good for all dogs. I have a new border collie. I would never take him to a dog park. He would hate it.
Really?
Yeah, I would never take him. What I would suggest doing, and maybe you've done this already, have you tried her playing with in a big yard somewhere with one other dog who's really polite and has good social skills?
Actually, it's strange that you should ask that. My mother is big on dachshunds, and she has a dachshund, and I take Judy out there sometimes, and she gets along pretty well with him. Sometimes it's kind of like she doesn't really understand what he is exactly.
Oh.
But, you know, she's kind of getting there, I guess.
I would let her tell you where her comfort zone is, because you're motivated by exactly the right thing, which is her happiness and the safety of others, obviously. She's obviously not a concern in that way. So I would just go a lot slower. I would see if there's somebody else out there who maybe has a smaller dog who's not sort of a leap on the head of another dog, so exuberant that they play really boisterously. But another dog, you know, a good thing to do is to get another dog, and rather than setting them up in a yard and like, okay, play now, just go on a walk with them. You know, go somewhere where you can go on a walk. And it takes the social pressure off. It's a little like if you have two kids you want to get together. You could just put them in a room and say, okay, you don't know each other now, play. Or you could all go miniature golfing together or something, you know. So the walk is sort of like miniature golfing. It's a social grease that sort of facilitates interaction without putting a lot of social pressure on them. So that's another thing to think about. Is you could, if you could set that up, that'd probably be really good.
Sure, that makes total sense.
Thanks, James, for calling. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks a lot.
You bet. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Kimberly from Green Bay, Wisconsin, Patricia. And she wrote to us after reading through some of the pet tips available on callingallpets.org on the website. And she found tips on how to deal with a cat that's splashing its drinking water everywhere, but she wasn't able to find information to help her specific situation. So maybe you can help here. Here's what she writes. My 1-year-old cat splashes outside of her water dish all the time. I live in a very small apartment, and I'm not able to keep the dish in the bathtub or put it in a basement. When I'm home, I'm able to deter my cat by spraying an air duster, but I can't always be there to watch her. Waking up and stepping into a puddle of water before I've had my coffee is rather unpleasant. Please help me find a way to keep my floor and my feet dry.
Poor baby. This is such a common problem, isn't it?
It is.
It's
happens
just
all the time.
Cat, yeah, cats love to play with their water, it seems like. And they're supposed to not like water, right? But they didn't read that chapter. That's part of what cats do, is they just do what they want to do. Well, there are a couple possibilities. One is sort of pathetically unoriginal idea is to put something like a little carpet sample or something absorbent under the dish. So when you're walking across your wooden floor or your tile floor or something, you don't end up walking barefoot in water. I mean, that's one possibility. Obviously, you'd put the water dish somewhere where...
Out of your trail.
Out of the trail, out of the highway of life in your in wherever you live. You also might want to try putting it up somewhere and then put an absorbent carpet. And then you would just switch them every day, you know, so you don't want a moldy old thing growing under your cat's dish. So that's one possibility. I know listeners have also sent in some other ideas. There's you can get dishes that, or you can make dishes that have a lid with a hole cut in the middle, so they can get their heads in there and they can lap. Now you have to make sure the water stays at a high enough level. That's a possibility. One other wild idea that might make things much worse, in which case you'll just love Larry, and I'll blame this all on Larry. I'll say that it was his idea.
It was my idea.
But Larry actually had this device. There's a waterer you can get for cats. Cats like running water. And there's a little fountain-like thing you can get for cats that has water that circulates around itself, and it has a little stream of running water.
It's fun.
And some, now your cat might think like, yeah, you know, now I'm really can spread water around the house. But it might actually, I've known a few cats who actually stopped playing in their water with that particular device. So those are a couple of ideas. We could go on all hour about others, but perhaps somebody else out there, this is a great time for people to get onto our website and leave a tip. Just go to callingallpets.org and tell us your solution to the cat playing in the water conundrum.
And thank you very much for that email question. I really appreciate it, Kimberly. And we thank everybody who calls, too, at 1-800-462-7413. Let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hey, how are y'all today?
Well, we're just great. Who are we speaking with?
This is Sandy. I'm in Shreveport, Louisiana.
I was thinking it wasn't New England.
You think?
Thanks a lot for calling, Sandy.
You're welcome.
Yeah, what can we do for you?
I have two female cats. They're not related. They're both volunteers. Just showed up and said, "You're ours." One of them has wonderful nighttime habits. When I go to bed, she goes to bed with me, to the extent head on the pillow, under the covers, like a people person. The other one, totally not. No way. All night long, it's craziness. I get fed up and toss her out of the bedroom, shut the door, and she spends the rest of the evening running down the hallway and hurling herself against the door.
How relaxing.
Amazing. This is the final step. This is after she has knocked everything off the dresser, gone in the kitchen and pushed canisters off of, thank goodness they're Tupperware, push canisters off of the counter. All manner of craziness. And this doesn't go on during the day, only at nighttime. And I'm at my wit's end.
So you realize you're doing a social service, because there are lots of listeners going like, well, my cat's not that bad. I thought I had it bad, but my cat's
poor
not
lady.
That bad. That poor woman.
What can I do?
Well, it sounds like you got a day cat and a night cat.
Yeah, yes. And so here's a question about the night. What does the night cat do during the day?
Well, since I'm at work, I'm not sure. I'm assuming sleeping on the windowsill with the sun blaring down, you know, that wonderful, ooh, I'm hot, I'm comfortable,
yeah,
I'm sleeping.
Yeah, cozy. And here's another question. How do these two cats get along? I'm wondering if one cat is a bit of an inhibition on your night cat. So sort of quiet during the day because he or she is a little inhibited, but then when the other one goes to sleep, it's like, yee-haw.
Yahoo!
You know, wahoo.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's going on between the two cats? Anything that might be relevant?
They play beautifully together and just seem to kind of adore one another, but at nighttime, something strange. I don't know.
You have one of those cats who has read the books and read the section that said that cats are nocturnal animals. So there are a couple things you could do. One, I would certainly look at the food that you're feeding your cat. Some foods act like giving Coca-Cola to four-year-old boys right before they're going to go to sleep. There, you know, and there's some foods that it's suggested are sort of more calming, you know. So you might want to look at like a turkey-based food, and you can sort of get the Thanksgiving effect.
Yeah, the tryptophan. You know?
Serotonin.
Yeah.
Look at tryptophan.
Tryptophan.
Yeah, right?
What did I say? Serotonin.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's similar, you know. So that's something very indirect, but that's something else to think about. Then don't wait for your cat to knock stuff off in the bureau in the bedroom. Start a routine where every night when you go to bed, the cat is not in the room. Get out of this pattern that the cat has of starting in the bedroom. Do not start in the bedroom. Create a nice, cozy sleeping place somewhere far away. I would put the cat in another room that does not give the cat access to the hallway so you can have these lunging dramas against your bedroom door. And just start a routine and stick with it.
And good luck.
Thank you. I'm going to need it.
You are, Sandy. But it can work. Thank you so much for calling.
Have your cat call if it doesn't work next time.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll welcome a guest to give us some insightful tips on how to raise the perfect parrot. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this week we welcome Rebecca O'Connor to the program. Rebecca is a professional bird trainer. She's worked at Disney's Animal Kingdom and is a frequent contributor to Good Bird magazine. And her new book is called A Parrot for Life, Raising and Training the Perfect Parrot Companion. And she joins us today to talk about it. Welcome to the program, Rebecca. Glad to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, first of all, how do we know if a parrot is the right pet for us?
There should be a lot of thought that goes into that. Parrots take just as much time as a dog or a cat. They're not an easy fix if you're looking for a pet that's not going to require as much time. And you should be willing to do the work because parrots, they aren't really as intuitive of a relationship as a dog or a cat. You might have to do some work trying to figure your bird out and keeping it from undesirable behaviors.
Well, I'm wondering what kind of specific considerations should you make before deciding actually to get a parrot?
Well, do you have the time? Okay, you don't have to walk your parrot, but you really should plan on spending a decent chunk of time with that bird every day. If you're going to be going away for long weekends, you don't get to just leave the parrot and not think about it. Someone's going to have to feed the parrot. You're probably going to have a house sitter. You may have a tough time finding a place for that parrot to go. And that parrot's going to live, depending on the species, anywhere from 20 to 50 or 60 years. I have people call me all the time why would we think about this? Dogs, cats, 20 years is a really long life.
That's right.
But I'll have folks call me that say, I've had this parrot for 30 years and I just love him, but we're going into assisted living home and we can't take him with us and the kids don't want him. There's just a lot of things like that that you need to think about. It's a lifestyle choice, not just, a cool pet.
What would be a good breed for a first-time parrot owner?
Parakeet. A parakeet or a cockatiel, they're a little smaller. They don't have as long as a lifespan. They've been bred in captivity for much longer than some of the larger species in that, they have lay clutches and have babies quicker. So in some ways they're slightly domesticated. They're a little bit more suited to our home than say a parrot that's like a T3 or a T4. It's just been out of the wild a few generations. So that's sort of a good place to start, especially if you're thinking you want to introduce younger folks.
I love my parakeets. I've had parakeets over the years and really, really enjoy them a lot. They're a lot of fun.
You know, the parakeets actually hold the record for the most words said.
That's very interesting.
Isn't that amazing? Those little tiny things, they have an amazing capacity to, you know, mimic sound.
And, you know, there's a very good point that you make in your book about sort of breed versus species difference, is that really it's not different breeds of parrots, it's different species. And so some of these animals are as different, you say, as dogs and cats in some ways.
Absolutely.
So it's really important to pay attention to what kind of parrot you get, right?
Well, anytime you get a parrot, I mean, I'm always telling people, you just have to do your homework. You know, it's not enough to go out and collect all the common wisdom about parrots. I mean, it's a good idea to become a scientist. You know, go pick up the journal, see what sort of parrot research is going on. If you're fortunate enough to have lots of money, shoot, go see them in the wild. There's a lot to learn about the various species, and the more you learn about them and, you know, what they generally do in the wild, the more what they do in your home is going to make sense.
Speaking of the wild, I saw some cockatoos in the wild in Sydney, Australia, and I thought of them when I was reading your book, and you talked about in your book that screaming is a learned behavior, and obviously it's one of the big problems that people have with their parrots, but I have to say I laughed when I read that part, because when I was in Sydney, Australia, a flock of cockatoos came in, and they were making the most hugely loud, raucous, boisterous, shrieking calls.
They are amazing. Those sulfur crested. I spent some time in a little place called Hillsville, and I'd wake up in the morning and go, oh, my goodness, whose cockatoos got loose? Oh, right, I'm in Australia. Thank you for bringing that up, though, because when I say screaming, I define it as a repetitive, loud behavior that repeats itself, you know, so much that it's not really... it's not really natural. Parrots are loud. Their normal vocalizations are loud, and boy, those cockatoos are up at the higher decibel range. But another behaviorist explains it like this. I mean, imagine if every time you wanted something, you had to scream at the top of your lungs for half an hour. That's not a natural behavior, and it can't be enjoyable for the parrot either. But what happens is, you know, they're normally loud, and then they learn that that loud behavior gets them attention, and so the intensity and the length of that behavior increases to the point of what I would define as screaming, as opposed to natural vocalizations.
That makes a lot of sense, and so it sounds as though what you're suggesting, which also makes a lot of sense, is that as soon as you get your parrot, from minute one, really, you want to be thinking about what do you do if your parrot makes a loud vocalization. Do you go to it? Because as soon as you do, you've given it attention, and they
right.
love attention, right?
Right. I mean, it's just like dogs. You know, as soon as you bring a new bird into your house, you need to be constantly thinking, what am I reinforcing? Because, you know, dogs are more intuitive, and they're a little more upset when we're upset with them. Parrots, they're wild. They don't really care. You know, they're just trying to sort of get some modicum of control over their environment and learning exactly what you teach them. So if you're always aware, if I drop a nut in this bird's bowl right now, what was this bird doing that I'm going to reward? If he was playing with a toy or sitting quietly in his cage, bonus. You know, but if he was screaming,
Well, let's talk about quality of life for just a minute. How do we ensure a good quality of life for a parrot, considering that, you know, it's going to be indoors in a confined space?
Well, I guess the easiest way to look at it is to think about what would this parrot be doing out in the wild, and what can I do to sort of emulate that environment so that, you know, he's enriched, and that's what toys and, you know, it's enrichment just like they do in a zoo to avoid stereotypical behavior. You have to, you know, come up with cool ways for the bird to have fun in its area. Certainly you're going to let it out of the cage as much as you can. You're going to get it as big of a cage as you can, but if you have, like, say, my birds, I like to take brown paper bag lunch bags, hide treats in them, roll them up, stick them in the cage. They have to get the bag open to get to the toys. You can do that with cereal boxes and crumple up newspaper on, you know, an area of the cage, the top of the cage or whatever, and hide food in there, just anything that might encourage them to forage and look for their food, which is what they'd be doing all day in the wild. That sort of thing is really critical to their quality of life.
That sounds like fun, too.
Oh, it's great fun.
It must be great fun to watch them. I have a question for you about a bit of a controversy. What is your feeling about clipping wings of parrots? What is your take on that?
You know, this is always such a tough question for me to answer because I border on being a hypocrite. I have two clipped parrots, one that's not clipped, and I'm a falconer, so I do, you know, free fly a falcon every year right around this time for a few months, and I free fly my pigeons. You know, to me, there is definitely something about being fully flighted that is very important to their physiology and mental well-being. But you have to balance that with the trouble and dangers that they can get into. Free flying outside is very different than free flying in a house, where you can fall into the toilet, get grabbed by the dog, fly into a boiling pot of water, run into the ceiling fan or the fireplace. It's really dangerous. And then it's dangerous outside, too. There's, you know, all kinds of birds of prey and, you know, dogs and coyotes and many, many things that can eat a parrot. So it's always going to be a personal decision, but it's a very tough one to make.
Rebecca, my wife and I and daughter Emily have been to Orlando, to Disney, half a dozen times, and our favorite spot is Animal Kingdom. And you've had experience training birds at Animal Kingdom, and we've seen the bird show there many, many times. Do you have any memorable experiences to share with us?
Oh, gosh. There's so much about that that was memorable. The gentleman that runs that show, Steve Martin, I was fortunate enough to get in on the ground floor, so the park wasn't even finished being built yet, and we were training birds in Florida preparing to start the bird show. And, of course, the bird show went through a lot of evolutions. I guess my funniest memory is we flew a lot of parrots. I mean, we had all kinds of birds. You've seen the show. There's,
yes,
you know, ducks and chickens and hawks and eagles and owls. But we flew our parrots in pairs a lot of times, and or at least housed them in pairs. And, of course, with free flight training, they do occasionally fly away. And since we had pairs of parrots, we like to give them paired-up names. And we had a pair of blue and golden caws that we named Gilligan and Skipper.
Mm-hmm.
We lost them both at the same time one day.
Oh, no.
So there were a bunch of us walking through the park when, you know, after it had opened, and there were plenty of people there yelling at the top of our lungs, Gilligan! Skipper!
And did people start singing the song?
Well, we did get quite a few strange looks.
Oh,
and did Gilligan and Skipper come back?
Yeah, we never permanently lost a bird the entire time I was there. Parrots don't really want to be out there if they've been trained from the ground up and they're flown every day and, you know, they're have relationships like we had with our birds at Disney's Animal Kingdom. I'm sure they still do. It's, you don't lose them. Plus, we're very serious about getting a bird back.
Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Rebecca O'Connor is the author of A Parrot for Life, Raising and Training the Perfect Parrot Companion. She joined us from her home near Palm Springs, California. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Rebecca's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. So if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at 1-800-400-8255. 462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of A Parrot for Life by Rebecca O'Connor. And here's today's question. According to Rebecca, there are many owners who swear that the Quaker or monk parrot is the best possible parrot. However, the Quaker parakeet is illegal in several states, including California, Kentucky, and Rhode Island. While these states fear that the parrot may displace native wildlife, the groundskeepers at Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, New York, allow a feral flock of Quaker parakeets to live there specifically because they keep another native nesting species away. What native nesting species is this? Ah, I'm thinking. You think you know the answer? Call us at 1-800-462-7413. And to find out the correct answer, check out our website in about a week. We'll have it posted online at callingallpets.org. And if you'd like to join us by phone, call us at 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Jeff from Vanceburg, Kentucky.
Jeff, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
We have a farm, live out in the country, and we have one neighbor. And the problem is they have four dogs, and they basically are all strays that they've taken in. We don't actually have any dogs ourselves, and there are no fences, between the property.
Mm-hmm.
Our property goes around both sides of theirs, and we're about 200 yards away. Well, the problem is three of their dogs, on a fairly regular basis, come up here to use the bathroom.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and it'll be in very conspicuous places, in the middle of the barn or right out our front door or on top of the well. Or
that's exactly where you want it, right?
Yeah, I mean, and it's like all this space out there. Why don't they use the field, or something like that? So my question is, I suppose, why do they do it, and is there anything that we could do as a natural deterrent? We have spoken to the neighbors sort of gently, kind of in passing that, the dogs come up, and they keep them tied up sometimes. But other than that, it's just you walk outside and there it is,
Yeah, and it is so often in a specific place in that kind of context, because we often think of dogs scent marking when they're urinating. That male dog lifts his leg, and we think of them scent marking and claiming their territory that way. But actually, the research, there's not a lot of it, but it looks as though they also use feces as a way of marking territory in some context. So particularly since it's so obvious, like on the well and, in the middle of the barn. So I think that's partly what's going on, too. As far as the dog's concerned, this is their territory. No other dogs live there, they can go in and out pretty much whenever they want. So that's the why. That doesn't really help you
that
necessarily.
Doesn't help a lot.
Right. Deterrence. The trick with deterrence is that, most farms have a lot of acreage on them. So if you do something in the barn, is that going to work on top of the well? No, So what you might want to do is focus on a couple of places. And one thing that can be very useful for some animals is pepper. It's easy. It's cheap. You sprinkle pepper in the bottom of your barn. If you have barn cats, this could be a problem. Do you have barn cats?
We do have a few cats.
Okay.
And we also have a wild turkey that has adopted us.
Oh, is that right?
He thinks we're her children.
So, that's sort of sweet. But that pepper is particularly useful for dogs because usually before they urinate or defecate, what do? They put their noses down and they sniff around. So one thing you might want to do is just do that for a couple of days, sort of corral the cats, put them elsewhere, put them in another shed or something like that, and that can be useful. There are all kinds of devices you can use to keep animals out of a barn, but your challenge is that you've got cats and this turkey, and your pet turkey.
So we want to protect them, but we want to do something to deter the dogs.
So the one thing I might want to try is find an area on the edge of the property and make it sort of interesting in that, one, say a dog leaves a present for you on the barn floor, scoop it up with a scooper, and move it over to where you
where to some designated area. Like, well, you know, it'd be nice if the dogs went here.
And good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
And, you know, this would be a great question for our listeners to send us a tip.
Oh,
just send us
right.
a tip. You can go to our website, go to callingallpets.org, or send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
We'd love to hear from you. And, Jeff, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Good luck. And let us know how it turns out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We'd love to hear. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Sarah in Dallas, Texas.
Sarah, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, my husband and I are having a problem with our cat. We took in this stray cat about 2.5 years ago because someone at the apartment complex moved away and left her outside.
Oh.
And I just can't imagine who would do something like that. But we took her in, and really, we think she's a rather spoiled cat. We allow her to go indoor, outdoor, because that's what she prefers. And when she's outside, she seems to be okay. But she comes in for most of the day and most of the night. And what happens is when she's inside, she cries all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we think it's because she's hungry, and we give her dry food all day long, and then she gets wet food in the morning and at night. And we've given her deli meat turkey because sometimes that quiets her for a little while.
Mm.
And we play with her, and when we're playing with her, she's not crying. But unless she's playing, and she would do it for hours and hours and hours, really just watch us play. But if she's not playing, sleeping, or eating, she's crying. And we really can't figure out what the problem is. She wakes my husband up in the middle of the night, midnight, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, to let her outside. So it's become such a problem that we, you know, it's becoming an impediment, really, to our living.
Oh, yeah, this sure. would be exhausting.
And you've had her to the vet, I assume, and...
We have, and the vet said she's healthy. There's not really anything wrong with her. The vet gave us some natural sort of homeopathic anxiety pills, but they're too large, and we just can't give them to her.
Mm. You know what you might want to try? There are a lot of things going on here, but the first thing that comes to mind is that artificially produced hormone or pheromone called Feel-Away. It's something you either spray in the room or there's actually a plug-in. Doesn't work all the time, but that's certainly something that I would give a try to. It's, you know, $30 for a plug-in. You might need more than one, though. That would be the trick, is how big your rooms are and sort of the logistics of your house. But I would definitely give that a try. The other thing I want you to think about really carefully is your behavior in relation to the cat crying. So let me replay some of the things you told us, is that you're trying to figure out why the cat is crying. And I did exactly this, by the way. Exactly. This is me, like 20-something years ago. So why is my cat crying? Does she want turkey? So I gave her turkey. Now, if you were walking around going like, I want, and somebody gave you Lady Godiva chocolate or something, that would be like a reinforcement. That would be like, well, actually, what I wanted was something else, but boy, I do love chocolate. So I'm going to walk around going, I want. And what we know about reinforcement is it is particularly effective if it's intermittent. So you couldn't work harder to keep your cat crying if you tried. If every once in a while you give her a little turkey, or is it this that she wants, or is it that she wants? And so basically, I don't know why she was crying initially. Mm-hmm. She might have had a hormone imbalance. That kind of crying is often crying for kittens.
Oh.
So there's a possibility there was a hormone imbalance, you know, sort of who knew why it initially started. But now it's partly been reinforced. She sort of learned that it's just the way to be. So you got to go cold turkey. You're going to have to absolutely not give her attention when she's crying. But wait for the 3 seconds when she's quiet. Then give her attention. Then give her a treat. Then give her toys. This is a program that you need to be really thoughtful about.
Okay.
It takes some energy for about 3 weeks or so. You need to be on high energy, always thoughtful about when you're giving her attention. But I would try that, and I would try Feel Away and see where that gets you.
Well, that's wonderful. At this point, we're willing to try anything.
Yeah,
so that's great.
Get back to us and let us know how things are going.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Sarah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Patricia, a few weeks ago, we talked to Bill in Florida, who was wondering what to do about the smell of his girlfriend's ferrets. Remember that?
Oh, I do.
We heard from a lot of listeners.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah, they had advice for Bill. Thought we'd share a few of those tips. One of the factors contributing to a ferret smell seems to be its diet. And listeners named Ernie and Lisa wrote to say that feeding ferrets cooked meat will prevent them from defecating so much. Well, that's one thing. Meanwhile, a Wisconsin listener named Sarah wrote in with a short list of easy steps to keep the smell down. First, wash all the bedding in the ferret's cage every 3 to 4 days and let it air dry. Second, be sure not to feed your parrot anything with fish byproducts in it. And finally, don't bathe the ferret too often. Doing so will cause the ferret to kick up its musk production, which only makes the problem worse.
And that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense as I think about it. Boy, we got great listeners.
And by the way, in that same show where we talked to Bill, we also heard from Vikas, who wanted to know which vacuum cleaner is best for picking up hair.
Oh, I'm all ears.
We received 55 emails about
that. Whoa, that's great.
The vacuum cleaner that has the most votes among our listeners is the Dyson Animal. Though our listeners point out that the vacuum cleaner is expensive, it runs about $500.
Oh.
They say it's scary what the vacuum cleaner can pull out of your carpet. The only drawback is that the vacuum cleaner is not self-propelled.
Is that Dyson D-Y-S-O-N?
Yeah, D-Y-S-O-N.
Dyson. I love it. 55 listeners. That's so great. I love it.
And the name of the vacuum cleaner is cool for this show, Dyson Animal.
Can we get one? Can we get one sent to my farm, please?
You might not want to know what it picks up out of your carpet, apparently.
Oh, as a biologist, I regret to say that I do not have the luxury of ignorance.
Patricia, thanks. We'll look forward to our next meeting next week.
Oh, absolutely. Me and my dirty carpet will be here.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster, and Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1006P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.
On the next Calling All Pets, we'll take a closer look at a big cat that gets no respect, the cougar.
And we'll also welcome a retired military officer to talk about his attempt to bring an abandoned puppy back from a rock.
We hope you'll tune in for that and more calls on the very next Calling All Pets.